Okay, all right, so flex torsion and the ground set of string theory. So, the standard model has had great success in describing elementary particles and their interactions. We have still not found a single subatomic process which cannot be described or is not compatible with it. Yet, however, the standard model has many free parameters, and we hope that there is a theory beyond the standard model capable of explaining quantities like the pattern of quark and lepton masses, right? So, within the standard model, we do not have answers to the question of why do we live in four dimensions? Why are there three families or generations? Why are the cosmological constants so small? Or why is the hierarchy so big? So, the list of questions can certainly go on and on. Well, string theory is our most promising candidate to answer questions like this. But of course, before we can answer them, we have to figure out what the ground state of string theory is. And I think it is fair to say that, yes, we still don't know. So we do not have the answer to the question of what the ground state is. Well, we don't actually know how many there are going to be. Is this going to be one ground state? Are this going to be 10,000? Or are there going to be maybe infinitely many ground states? Well,
whether the ground state in a cosmological setting is the right question.
Right. So even if it is the right question, this is exactly the point. So this is exactly the point I wanted to make at the conclusion. So I'm still at the beginning. So we do not have the answer yet, but we have bits and pieces of the story. And well, I would like to talk here about what I consider is going or is important information to determine where the ground state of string theory is going to be. But first, I need a bigger piece of chalk. All right, so let me start by briefly mentioning some old work. So we all know that if we compactify 11-dimensional supergravity on a compact Calabi-Yau fourfold, the expectation value for tensor field, for the tensor field is going to vanish, right? 11-dimensional supergravity on a compact Calabi-Yau fourfold implies that the expectation value for the tensor field is going to vanish. Well, in this case, we of course have many more ground states than we actually want. We have all these flat directions corresponding to the different shape and sizes of the internal manifold. Well, luckily, this is not the whole situation, and we know that there are quantum gravity corrections, right? So quantum gravity corrections cause, for example, the tadpole cancellation condition to change to something like this. Integral over the Calabi-Yau fourfold FHF is going to be equal to the Euler character of the Calabi-Yau fourfold, Euler characteristic of the Calabi-Yau fourfold over 24. So what this means is that in order to make sense of compactifications on manifolds with a non-vanishing Euler characteristic, we have to take these fluxes, of course, into account. And well, we all know that supersymmetry is going to be unbroken if certain conditions are satisfied. Well, the flux has to be primitive, and certain components of the flux and their complex conjugate have to vanish, right? So this condition is going to determine the sum of the Keller moduli for us. Keller moduli.
Catherine?
Yes?
You're looking at compactifications for three dimensions?
Yes, three dimensions. So because now I would like to generalize. So I would like to consider different types. This is 11-dimensional supergravity to three external dimensions. Then we are going to look at compactifications to six dimensions. That's clear, certainly. Okay?
are these conditions going to determine? Some of the Keller moduli, these conditions over here are going to determine complex structure moduli. So this means that some of the flat directions we have in the supergravity approximation are lifted after we take quantum gravity corrections into account, right? So this is why this so flux compactifications are important in order to say something about the ground state of string theory. So, but even though this is a general class of solutions, it's not the most general type of flux background one can write down. I would like to call this a conventional compactification. And in this talk, I would like to present a few examples of some non-conventional compactification. So let me call this conventional. Okay, so what else can we do? I would like to consider something that is more general, and I would like to discuss different examples. In my first example, I would like to stick to the case of M3 compactified on a Calabi-Yau fourfold. So, and we are going to see that this is not the most general type of solution. Questions? See if you look puzzled.
Well, not.
You're not? Okay, right. You shouldn't be yet.
Well, no, this is not about anything you've said.
That's good.
Just as ground stuff.
Life's tough.
So, example number one. So, I would like to consider M3 in a Calabi-Yau fourfold, the general case. So, in order to find the most general type of supergravity background, we are going to solve the conditions for unbroken supersymmetry, right? So, we are going to set the supersymmetry variation of the gravitino equal to zero, right? And up to constants, we all know that the supersymmetry transformation is given by an expression like this, right? Where F and Fm are the usual contractions M and PQ of the field strength and the gamma matrices. And in the same way for this fellow over here, PQR. Now, in the following, I would like to assume that we have over here an 11-dimensional spinner, and I would like to decompose it into a three-dimensional anti-commuting spinner times an internal component. And I will take the internal component to be of the following form. It can have two different chiralities that I would like to call theta plus and theta minus. So they are made in such a way that we get different results for the chirality. This means that I'm going to give up the condition that the spinner on the internal manifold, or that this part of the spinner over here is a Weil-Majorana spinner. So how the things are related to the covariantly constant spinner of the Calabi-Yau fourfold, we are going to see in a moment. So, what else? So I'm going to put this condition. Furthermore, I would like to impose the condition that the flux is going to be self-dual. F is equal to star F. Well, this actually makes sense because this is something that we can derive from the equations of motion. Okay?
Derive from the equations of motion, assuming what? You mean it's complex or supersymmetry?
If we solve the equation of motion and we only assume that the internal manifold is a Calabi-Yau fourfold, then you can show that the flux has to be self-dual. Just the equations of motion. So no supersymmetry and nothing. Now, so we are going to assume that.
Well,
question?
But you already assumed the metrics call the out. So you're adding fluxes on the automatic column.
Right. I'm doing nothing to the background. It's still a Calabi-Yau fourfold. It's going to be a little bit odd Calabi-Yau, but it's still a Calabi-Yau.
So it turns out that the primitivity condition is indeed corrected. So for this more general case, f with j is no longer going to vanish, but it's going to be equal to the derivative of v, where v is, and this again can be obtained from supersymmetry, v is an holomorphic Kling vector. Right, a moment ago this fellow over here was equal to zero, now we have a correction of this type, and the other components are also still going to vanish. 3-1 is still going to be equal to zero. Now, so when, again, on a Calabi-Yau forfeit, we have only one covariant constant spinner. So what are these two things, zeta plus minus, I introduced a moment ago? Well, it turns out that we can identify zeta minus, for example, one of the chiralities, with the covariantly constant spinner on the Calabi-Yau forfeit, and if such an holomorphic Kling vector exists, then we can just express zeta plus in terms of zeta minus in this way. Something like this. Okay, so these are our two spinners. Right, so in order to be able to, questions?
So the you say if there's a holomorphic Kling vector, then you get this.
Right. So when is there going to be an holomorphic Kling vector? That is of course the solution. That is of course the question. Well, this is not going to exist in many cases because of the following reason. It turns out that for any compact Ricci flat manifold, the Kling vector is going to be covariantly constant. So this means that if we have a compact manifold, I mean, the Calabi-Yau is going to be Ricci flat. If it is compact, then this fellow is going to vanish and we are back to the usual case. So the only case where we can find a generalized solution like this is if the Calabi-Yau forfeit is non-compact. So this makes, of course, the supergravity analysis somewhat tricky. It's possible to write down explicit solutions of these conditions, but again, everything is going to be non-compact. So, the holomorphic Kling vector will only if the Calabi-Yau forfeit is non-compact. Okay, so a solution of this will only be possible if we have maybe some kind of singularities or something. We are using the supergravity approximation, so this is of course a little bit tricky. And we are back to the conventional case, so to say. Are there questions about this? So this is one type of generalized solution, and I would actually claim that this is the most general thing one can do for a Calabi-Yau forfeit. Now, so this is an example of what I would like to call non-conventional background. Let me come to example number two. So and this one we found by explicitly solving the supergravity conditions, right? So what we usually do. So, example number two. I would like to write down another example of a non-conventional background, but I will not be deriving the general conditions on this background by solving some kind of supersymmetry constraints. So the only thing I'm going to do is to conjecture the existence of a non-conventional background by using a chain of string dualities. So in the following, we will use string dualities. Moreover, in this case, what I would like to do is to work with a six-dimensional space-time. So compactifications. So six dimensions. So
the starting point for the chain of string dualities will be a compactification of the heterotic string on a manifold with torsion. So, start with the heterotic string on a manifold with torsion. So, we know that if we don't embed the spin connection into the gauge connection, right, so if dh equals trace r with r minus trace f with f, if this is not equal to zero, then we know that the space-time metric is going to be warped, right, so a warp factor will appear. The metric will then look something like this. Zero. Again, we are working here in compactification, so six external space-time dimensions plus a warp factor times a metric over here. So what I would like to do is to use a four-dimensional metric, and this is going to be K3. And moreover, and this is the warp factor. And this is the six-dimensional external space-time. So,
Sorry, why is it coordinated on K3?
What I would like to do is to apply a chain of string dualities to a compactification of heterotic string. We are taking our compactification to six external space-time dimensions, and the internal manifold is going to be conformal to K3. So for the case that we have dh not equal to zero, we don't embed the gauge into the spin connection, the internal manifold is going to be conformal to K3. This is an address word of the Strom-Meter 1990s or something. So he worked out this example. Okay?
So the answer is yes. Why is it K3 coordinate? Why is it K3
coordinate? Oh,
the coordinate.
Yeah, I mean.
You're not working really. You're just, yes.
It's still a product metric, but the metric is not Ricci Flatters.
Exactly. So it's, right. So it's still a product metric over here, but this thing is not Ricci Flat, so because of this warp factor, right? So, what else do we know? We know that if we want supersymmetry to be preserved, then the space-time is going to be flat, so it's going to be Minkowski space. Moreover, we know that the warp factor is related to the dilaton, right? So delta is going to be equal to 5. Now, in the presence of this warp factor, we have expectation values for tensor fields, right? So we have torsional constraints. So H is going to be equal to R times the derivative of J, where J is the fundamental form that for this case is proportional to the Keller form of K3. So once again, it's not closed because of the warp factor, right? So this is the fundamental form. So not closed because of the warp factor, right? Okay.
This is terminology, but usually you don't call something like that a warp factor unless it involves the other coordinates, right? It's a conformal factor.
What?
A warp factor if you have a function of y in front of
you. Okay, so this is a special case of a more general construction, let me say it this way.
Okay, but it's still not usually called a warp factor. Anyway.
Let me call it the left one.
What's a conformal factor?
Conformal. Let's not fight about this part. brain for other things to talk about. So, okay, so what else? So, again, what I would like to do is to start with a metric like this, apply a chain of string dualities. So, I would like to work explicitly with a metric. So, what I would like to do is to work in the orbifold limit of K3 so that I have a nice metric that I can take to be flat, right? So, going to become a work factor in a moment. Okay, so I want K3, I want to go over to the orbifold limit. So I would like to represent K3. I would like to set it equal to T4 mod the identification in the 6, 7, 8, and 9 direction. So this is 0 to 5, this are the direction 6, 7, 8, 9, right, where this operation over here is going to change the sign in the coordinates of this torus, right? Now, so in this orbifold limit, we have a metric that is flat, right? So the metric is flat. DZI bar. And moreover, the flux, the background flux for the erotic is going to be given by something like, well, a bunch of harmonic 1-1 forms, which the derivative of the work factor plus another band of 1-1 forms times the anti-holomorphic derivative. So this N and M are harmonic 1-1 forms. So this 1-1 forms are made in such a way that the torsion constraint is going to be satisfied, right? So far, so good. Now, it turns out that, again, this is a background for the erotic, and this can be transformed into a background for type 1, right?
Does delta have poles and zeros?
Delta have poles and zeros. Let me think for a moment. Delta have poles and zeros.
It's homomorphic first. Well, I guess it's
not homomorphic.
Does it have zeros and infinities then? That would correspond to NS5 brains and whatever. I don't know the other thing.
This is going to give us some kind of five brains. So in general, I would say no. So
this is
exactly what I'm after. So I don't want to construct another kind of brain solution, but I would like to have some kind of fluxes. I mean, where we don't need to have some kind of sources, some kind of pores or something in this work factor. So this is what I'm trying to do, and this can be found by making really the supergravity analysis. I will have to say more about this in a moment.
And this was heterotic, so you didn't tell us about the gauge field strength, but that just follows.
I didn't tell you about the gauge field, so I'm going to assume that something like, okay, so we have pH is equal, okay, I have it over here, right, and H is going to be related to the derivative of the work factor, E bar of J, and J once again, 10 times the work factor. So, I mean, this is heterotic, and if you want the condition on the work factor, you're going to solve this over here. So what I'm going to do is assume that I know the work factor, but I've not solved this equation explicitly for the moment. So, but in order to do that, we, of course, would need to know what the gauge fits are, but this is actually not what I wanted to do right here, so I'm going to assume that I know how the work factor looks like. Okay? So we are working for the erotic, and now I would like to go over to a background for the one theory. From the heterotic background, we saw for the metric, we can go over to the type 1 side by using the relation that we can have a metric on the type 1 side equal to the inverse heterotic coupling constant. The metric And I'm going to merge a couple of concepts then. So, on the type 1 side, I'm going to have a metric like this. There's a minus 1, and now I can calculate log factor because. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 plus the of k3. So again, I'm working in the orbifold limit of k3, and in the following, I actually would like to make an additional simplification. I would like to go to find the moduli space of k3, where I can represent it as t2 times t2 mod reflections I 6, 7, 8, 9. So, we started with a background for the theoretic. Now we have a background. This is a background for type 1. And now I would like to convert this into a background for type 2b. And I'm going to be a little bit sketchy when talking about the string dualities because this is based on older work by Sen. So we can represent this type 1 background as a background for type 2b modeled out by the Wolchi parity transformation, right? So this is type 2b, let me write it this way, modeled out by the Wolchi parity transformation. Now, as has been shown by Sen, this is actually nothing else than a convectification of F3 on a Calabi-Yau threefold that is an elliptic vibration with a base given by CP1 times CP1. So, as shown by Sen, this is dual convectification of F3 on a Calabi-Yau threefold, which is an elliptic vibration. Over a CP1 times CP1 base. So these are older papers. Let's see, these are HEPTH 97 and 96 and something. Maybe I should write it down over here. So and so on. So the way, I'm not going to explain the details, but the way to go over to the F3 or type 2b side is to take one of the stores, let's say these are directions that I would like to call 8, 9 directions, and to perform 2T dualities. So in this way, we can go over from this background over here for the type 2b3 to something that can be lifted to F3, and that is a compactification on this manifold Calabi-Yau threefold with this base that is given by CP1 times CP1. So to summarize, what do we have? So we have the heterotic on K3. It's going to be T-dual. We make 2 T-dualities in the 8 and 9 directions. 2 type 2B on CP1 times CP1 with non-constant Dilaton. Right, and what I would like to do, again, since I'm working in this orbifold limit, is to take the heterotic compactified unconformal K3 and see what kind of metric I get on the type 2b side. So I can do explicit computations. I just start with the metric over here, and I do all this chain of dualities, and I actually can get a metric for the type 2b side. But, of course, in order to do that, I have to make sure that I'm allowed to use the supergravity approximation on the heterotic side and on the type 2b side.
Questions?
So this is supposed to be true away from the orbifold point?
This is supposed to be true away from the orbifold point. I mean, the orbifold limit is, of course, only something that we use in order to write on a metric, but it's supposed to be true away from it. Yeah. I mean, this is what all this work by Sen and so on is all about. We don't need all that stuff. So the only thing I would like to use is the orbifold limit to get an explicit metric over there. And how I get away from the orbifold limit, I'm going to mention a moment ago for the type to be set.
You had gauge shields in the Hadronic case. How did they trace through to the end?
Gauge field to the end. Oh dear. Type to be, maybe on the type to be side, maybe the seven brain.
So the gauge fields, the seven brains can have gauge fields on them in F theory. Is that part of the
Yeah, that is part of it. But again, I will not have to say much about the gauge fields, but they will come from the seven brain. That is, of course, true. Okay, now. So. I want to look at a supergravity solution on the type 2B side. I first have to show that I'm allowed to do that. So how can I check that? I have to have a look, of course, at all the coupling constants. Let's see. So why am I allowed to do that? We start with, map the coupling constants. So what do we have? We have a type 2B on CP1 times CP1, right? And we are going to call the volume of CP1 V1, and the volume over there, we are going to call it V2. And we, of course, want those to be big if we want to use the supergravity approximation. And the string coupling constant is supposed to be small. And now we can trace back of how all the coupling constants behave under this chain of dualities. So let me do that. It's only a piece of chalk over here. Okay, it's only a small piece, but it's okay. I think I can manage. Okay, so what do we have? We have two volume, the volume V1 and V2. So we go over from type 2B to the type 1 side. The string coupling constant on the type 1 side is going to look in this way again. So what we are doing is two T dualities in one of these two tori that we had in the K3. So this is the string coupling constant. The first volume behaves in this way. The second volume in this way, and the string coupling constant in six dimensions is given by the type 2B coupling constant over the square root of V1 times V2. So this is on the type 1 side. And we can, of course, now go over to the heterotic side. So the coupling constant is going to be V1 over alpha prime times GB, the volume alpha prime over GB. And so on and so forth. Great, thank you. And the coupling constant on the heterotic side in six dimensions, 1 over alpha prime, square root of V1 over V2. So since we want, again, so this V1 and V2, these are the volumes on the type 2B side. We want to use a supergravity approximation. We want those fellows to be big. So we are going to scale them. Something like V1 is going to behave as some small number, epsilon, to some kind of negative power. Alpha is some kind of positive number that we may choose. V2 is going to be, or is going to behave, we are going to scale it in this way. Now we take the scaling behaviors and compute all our coupling constants. And well, as a result, what we get is that the total volume on the type 1 side is going to scale with epsilon to the power alpha minus beta. The string coupling constant in six dimensions on the type 1 side, alpha plus beta over 2. The volume on the heterotic side is going to scale as epsilon power minus alpha minus beta, and G on the heterotic side is going to scale as epsilon to the power beta minus alpha over 2. So what I claim is that we can choose our scaling behaviors. We can choose the value of alpha and beta in such a way that on all sides of the dualities, the volumes of the entire manifold are going to go to infinity, and the string coupling constants are going to be small, so that I can say I'm allowed to use the supergravity approximation. So you look puzzled.
I think by the grammar, you said all of that, you mean in different regimes, not all at once.
So what we want is, we are here, so, let me explain. So we are on the heterotic side, we wrote down a solution of the supergravity conditions, right? We want to throw this metric, tensor fits everything, through the chain of string dualities. We are going to get something on the type 2b side, and I want to argue that on the type 2b side, this is going to be a solution of the supergravity conditions. So I'm allowed to look at the metric, I'm allowed to look at the tensor fields. At the background that I'm going to get, I want to conjecture that this is a solution of the supergravity constraints on the type 2b side. So I have to know that all these coupling constants are going to do what we want. Okay? All right. So I would like to take the type 1 background and again apply all the chain of dualities. So on the type 1 side, what did we have? This was equal to the warp factor 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 plus delta minus 1 ds square cp1 plus ds square cp1. Now to one of these cp1s, so again I'm on a special point in the moduli space of K3. I want to apply 2T dualities to one of those fellows, and then we get the metric on the type 2B side. So let me call this maybe the 8 and 9 directions. We apply the T dualities, and we get a metric like this. So 4, 5 plus delta to the power minus 1 ds square cp1 plus. The metric actually looks quite similar to the one on the type 1 side. The only big difference are the powers of the warp factor. So while the solution over here was conformal to something that was Ricci flat, now we have two different powers over here. This is delta to the minus 1, this is delta. So I claim that this is not Ricci flat, and it's not even conformal to a Ricci flat manifold. So this is
Here's a
little tricky point, of course. I mean, what we want is actually, it's not Ricci flat, of course. I mean, I'm not going to say CP1 is Ricci flat, but I want the volume to be really, really big so that actually I can think about this as being something flat. I mean, I'm in the supergravity limit where I say this,
the size of the thing is going to be really big. So I'm going to take this actually to be a flat metric. So flat, maybe we even say this is going to be R2 mod I, for example, something like this. So maybe some kind of flat.
I'm confused by that. What do you mean by you're going to think of that as being R2 mod?
Yes, the problem is the following. We are working here for K3, but I want to work in the orbifold limit, so I'm working actually with a metric that up to boundary conditions is going to be flat. And I said that I want to go to a special point where this K3 factorizes into two factors, right? I mean, where they are independent, so that I can say to one of these, I'm going to apply the T-dualities. And again, I want these two factors, I mean, to have an infinite volume, so to say. I mean, I want it to be really big so that I can apply the supergravity approximation. Okay? All right. So I want to claim that this is okay. So I want to claim that this is a background that we found in the ROB fault limit. Maybe I should make my statement a little bit more precise. So this is a background that we found in the ROB fault limit. But what I claim is that if we would solve the supergravity conditions, we would find over here examples of what I would like to call non-conventional backgrounds, where the internal manifold is not going to be Ricci flat, nor it's going to be conformatory Ricci flat manifold. So it's not going to be like on the heterotic side. So this was found. This metric was found in the ROB fault limit. So let's, for the moment, let's go away from the ROB fault limit, right? On the heterotic side, we would say this is conformal to K3, K3 is Ricci flat, right? So we would agree on that. Now, let's say I would like to check what the conditions on this background are, what the properties are. I would not work with a special metric, but I would take the supersymmetric conditions, and I would like to see what kind of conditions I get from there, maybe what replaces Ricci flatness, what are the conditions on the fluxes. And what I claim is that if we take the type 2B theory, we compactify to 6 space-time dimensions. There are manifolds, four-dimensional internal manifolds, that are not going to be Ricci flat and that are going to satisfy some kind of general constraints. I have not done the supergravity computation yet, but I claim that this is going to be a solution of that. So this metric was found in the ROB fault limit, the general constraints on the four-dimensional internal manifolds. Can be found by solving the conditions for unbroken supersymmetry. So, and it's not only the statement that we have a metric that may be something that is something that may not be Ricci flat. But we are also going to get some kind of tensor fields in our background. So he wrote those down. Questions? So as a result, the tensor fields on the type 2B side, I claim what we get is, so let me call maybe the directions in which we perform the T-dualities x, y, or 8, 9, or whatever. So y, on the type 2B side, we are going to get a Ramon-Ramon-3 form, given in terms of the type 1 tensor fields in this way, and we are going to get an axion. So this is the type 2B side. Type 2B, this over here is going to be the type 1 side x, y, mu. So this is type 1. So this are, if we trace back how the tensor fields behave, this is the result we get. So on the type 2B side, I claim we have a solution with non-vanishing tensor field. This is in 6 dimensions, the type 2B theory. We know that the dilaton on the type 2B side is not going to be constant, but is going to be given by the warp factor, so that this is some kind of non-trivial F3 compactification because the dilaton is not constant. So again, I claim that this is an example. Is an example of a non-conventional background. And the conditions on this thing can be found by solving the supergravity constraints. Questions? David?
How does a function
out? The coordinates of K3. Why? What factor?
Yeah.
to be side, we would get some kind of semirends. Yes.
So how is this? Let me see. Yeah. So is this just a generalization, for example, of the in this case to K3 of the kinds of ones that, for example, we looked at as well?
What did you work at?
Well, the, you know, the paper I wrote with Joe.
Maybe we should. Maybe we should talk. Yeah, it could be. Yeah. So.
So you've gone through the series of dualities to arrive at what should be a solution. Can you verify directly that that's a solution?
Exactly. That's the point. I mean, so what I claim is this can be done. It should not be very difficult. So we could. It should be possible to verify directly this solution from the supergravity point of view. So good point. I mean, this is the next thing I would like to.
The spinner was all.
This is going to be a complicated spinner.
Okay.
Are these all dual to what? Something they call type A models. That is, the spinners have a simple relation between them. Because that the original, Andy's original supersonic dispersion had, although they didn't have the same spinner as yours, they had a simple spinner. It was.
I think the thing to do over here is just try to do the most general thing. I mean, this is a very simple model, the internal manifold is four-dimensional, so it should not be possible. We can here, in order to solve this, just make the most general answers for the spinner and see what you get. So, I mean,
that's not what you're doing yet. Here, your chain of dualities began with.
I claim that if we would do that from the supergravity point of view, we would arrive at a solution like this. This is what I claim. So, I say that using the chain of string dualities, we get a background, and because conventional solution, there's nothing like that in six dimensions, right? So imaginary self-dual is not going to have a solution over here, trivially. I mean, there's nothing we can write down, right? And this is going to
fall. You say because you're in six dimensions, things are much more, there are much more constraints.
So, I mean, there is nothing that is going to solve imaginary self-dual solutions. So this has to be something new. And, well, it could be found by performing this, maybe some kind of nice supergravity ansatz. And it should be possible because this is only a four-dimensional internal manifold. So, I mean, it should be easy to work this out. So. More questions? Okay, so these are examples. I mean, either way, I mean, these are examples of compactifications, which, maybe either conventional or non-conventional, and, well, these are all ground sets of string theory, and, well, I mean, these are two examples of non-conventional compactifications, but I'm pretty sure that more of those will be around. So there are certainly many, many ground states. So let me come actually to the conclusions. Excuse me?
Supersymmetric
and non-supersymmetric. There are many of those. All the ones I'm discussing are supersymmetric. I briefly mentioned that there are backgrounds that are not supersymmetric. We only actually have to impose a self-duality condition to solve equations of motion if there are going to be corrections to those. It's a whole different story, but of course there are non-supersymmetric backgrounds. So, conclusions. What can we conclude? Okay, after taking quantum gravity corrections into account, most string and M-theory compactifications are only consistent if fluxes are taken into account, right? So if fluxes appear, we have seen this. A typical example of this is this tadpole cancellation. So quantum gravity corrections are equivalent to fluxes. Well, the good thing is that these fluxes cause several effects, I mean, that are really vital to make contact between string theory and the real world, right? I mean, we know that with the fluxes, or Joel or Steve know this very well. One can say something about the hierarchy problem, right? One, for example, with fluxes can break supersymmetry in four dimensions from n equal to 2 down to n equal to 1 and even down to n equal to 0. We can induce potentials for moduli fields, right? So, I mean, these are all things that are very important if you would like to make contact with string theory and the real world. Yet, with or without fluxes, we still have many, many flat directions. We still have all this vacua, right? And so, as things look right now, we still need some kind of mechanism to decide which vacua we are going to pick as the one single ground set of string theory. So at this moment, we don't know. Maybe it's going to be some kind of symmetry breaking mechanism. Maybe there is going to be the anthropic principle involved. Maybe it's just going to be luck. Maybe it's going to be a combination or none of those. I mean, at this moment, we just don't know. But I still think that even if some of those ground states or some of the parameters are going to be chosen randomly, I still think that we are going to have predictive power in string theory. I mean, I still find it encouraging that a few quantum gravity corrections bring us closer to the real world, right? A few of those do. So this makes at least me think that deep down in the world wide web of string dualities, there may be this vacuum, well, that maybe has a few free parameters, hopefully less than the standard model, and maybe it looks like the world around us. But at this moment, well, we don't know. That's all I wanted to say. Questions?
So do these more general classifications that preserve supersymmetry only work for type 2? The simple classification that we've known preserve two supersymmetries.
Yeah.
But only one in the heterotic.
Oh.
So if you're trying to do your more general things.
Good question. I don't know. I should try.
Are you preserving two supersymmetries?
So I'm preserving two supersymmetries. I mean, it depends on the model, right?
Two,
I mean, I've been discussing different models. So in the three-dimensional one, I was preserving n equal to 2 supersymmetry. So n equal to 2, then the six-dimensional one. Don't remember. That's a good point. Yeah, good question. I don't know. Should think about that. Good question. More questions?
I thought you were going to say something about that we might not want to ground state.
That we want?
That we might want to ground history as opposed to a ground state.
Well, I mean, again, I thought I did, right? I mean, I think we are going to have all this many, many ground sets, as I think we do, but I also still think that, I mean, and so some of those are going to be chosen randomly. I believe that, but I still think that there are many, many things that we don't know, and there are many parameters in the standard model, and I mean, which ones of those we can now say are going to be chosen randomly and which ones are going to be computed is of course the million-dollar question. But I'm pretty sure that we are not going to end up saying, well, we computed the mass of the electron by maybe some kind of formula or something. So some of those may be chosen randomly, but others not. Which ones? But I think we are going to end up with a whole history and a whole bunch of ground states. And I actually think it's going to be infinitely many. I don't think it's going to be 10,000 or 100,000. But it's not something bad. I mean, we know this from macroscopic physics, right? We have many systems that have many, many ground states, and we have to choose, right? So it happened before. So we have to learn to live with it. But we still can do macroscopic physics, even if this is the case. So we have to learn to ask the right questions. More questions?
So you made an argument that this new class of applications Do you now have an expectation that this is the most general class in some sense, or is this just one more step in trying to raise three-dimensional and six-dimensional cases?
For the six-dimensional case, I would say it's the most general one. For the three-dimensional, I would be a little bit careful before claiming something like this.
Is that a guess, or is there a proof, or what's that?
For the six-dimensional one, I think for the six-dimensional one, I only presented one simple metric. So this is nothing general. It's only one single metric. So what I claim is it should be possible to do the supergravity analysis for that case in a closed form. That should not be a big deal. With the three-dimensional one, it's a little bit tricky because the manifold is non-compact. So one has to be a little bit careful with the supergravity analysis. So one could run into trouble if using, for example, something that falls from equation of motion. If I say I use the self-duality condition, well, if the manifold is non-compact, there could be boundary terms that could make everything a little bit complicated. So I would be careful with that case. More questions?
In the six-dimensional case,
yes.
If you reduced on five of the spatial directions, then you're looking for supergravity solutions in five dimensions, and quite a lot is known about the general form of supersymmetric supergravity solutions in five dimensions.
Actually, I considered many cases, but I still didn't think about that one.
So you'd have to reduce the 2B.
Yeah.
There's been quite a lot of progress in understanding the general nature of supersymmetric solutions in five dimensions. So it might be a promising way to actually.
Well, if you just take these and compactify on the circle, I think I must fit it to the classification.
So?
You really got a classification? Or is
it depends what you mean by classification. there are necessary and sufficient conditions for supersymmetry. But it's only been done for certain theories.
So. Interesting.
What work is that?
Well, this is the work that I did with Jerome Gordon and Chris Holden. So that was just for the more fragmented supergravity, but can extend into non-minimal theories.
Great question. More questions?
If there are no more questions, let's thank you.